This is the passage that's referred to as the Olivet Discourse. It gets its name because this is the teaching that Jesus gave on the Mount of Olives. It's the teaching that he gave on the night prior to his betrayal and subsequent death. And it is the longest, in the Gospel of Matthew, sustained teaching in the entire Gospel. If you are simply counting words, Jesus says more in this section of teaching than he says in any other teaching in the Gospel. And that includes the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7, which is itself a pretty lengthy teaching. This sermon appears in some form in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it is the only teaching from the lips of Jesus that we have about the end times. And so as we study the last days and the days after that, this is a natural place for us to spend some energy. This is, other than the book of Revelation itself in its entirety, this is the only sustained teaching in the entire New Testament on the last days, on the things that will be before Christ comes again. It's no surprise then, given the wide-ranging interest people have in the subject of the last days, that this has also become one of the more controversial texts in the New Testament. One of the more controversial passages in the Gospel and some of the more controversial words from the lips of our Lord. I think that we are well helped in our study of this text if we keep ever before us what Jesus is doing here. What specifically is he talking about? What is he trying to address? What questions is he answering? And what do those answers mean for us in 2013? Now, I recommended two passages to you, Matthew 24 and Mark chapter 13. And I'm going to use both of them in the sermon. And they both have different advantages. You know, Matthew helps us because Matthew is a gospel of a great amount of detail. Matthew includes a significant amount of teaching material from the lips of Jesus. And so he has a lot of words here. And sometimes the more sentences that we have from Jesus, the more words, it helps us to better understand exactly what it is that he's talking about. Mark, of course, records less of the detail. He has this sermon, but he boils it down to its core essentials. And that's helpful too. One, because it's easier to cover in a one-night sermon, but also because it helps us connect the dots between the context better. When you read two full chapters in Matthew, you might have forgotten what happened in chapter 23. But in Mark, it's very easy to see what happens immediately, of course, Mark using that word, immediately before Jesus begins this teaching. So we'll talk about that context. First is the narrative context. You see that most clearly in the 12th chapter of Mark. At the end of that chapter is when Jesus is in conflict with the Jewish authorities in the temple. He's confronted in the temple by those rulers who wish to trap him in order to make him guilty of a crime that would deserve death. That's their goal, is that if they could goad Jesus into a clear statement of blasphemy, then Jesus would be deserving of death and they would get what they wanted, which is to crucify him. So that event takes place in the temple. See Mark 12, verse 35. And as Jesus taught in the temple, he said, and he makes this argument, and he will pronounce words of condemnation on the scribes who right before that were trying to trick him. The Sadducees had asked him a question. He'd been asked about taxes just before that. Everybody's trying to set a trap for him. And so Jesus walks out of the temple where this confrontation took place. And the first thing he did, Mark chapter 13, as he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. Jesus walks out of the temple and the confrontation that took place in the temple, and the first words out of his mouth are to predict the destruction of that very temple. He'll make that prediction even on the eve of his own death. He will then go on to be killed for the words that he said in that temple. He committed, to their mind, the blasphemies that they were looking for, and they will kill him. And so what our job is, as studiers of the Bible, as seekers of the Word of God, is to try and understand how all that is connected. Why does Jesus have that confrontation? Why does he walk away from that confrontation and predict the destruction of the temple when the very next event is not the destruction of the temple, but the destruction of Jesus? The death of our Lord. We need to see this so that when we get into the next portion of the text, we don't miss the forest for the trees. And quite often, when people are studying last days prophecy, when they're studying about the end times, they miss the forest completely because those trees are just so interesting. There's so much there that intrigues us. Jesus' death is the very thing that will make the temple obsolete. When Jesus walks out of the temple, when he walks away from that confrontation, and the disciples marvel at the majesty of that building, Jesus knows that the events of the next 24 hours will render that building utterly meaningless. It'd be unfathomable to a first century Jew that the temple would become meaningless. But that, in light of Jesus' death, is exactly what will happen. If God is going to dwell with his people in the person of the Holy Spirit, what need is there for a building that is the dwelling place of God? If within 24 hours, Jesus is going to offer the perfect, once and for all sacrifice, what need is there for an altar upon which the blood of bulls and goats can be spilled? Jesus is the fulfillment of all that the temple was ever meant to be. The temple was a place of intercession, but he is our great intercessor. The temple represented the presence of God with the people, but Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. All that God had planned for his people and done for them was done in a better way in Christ. Everything that the temple could do, it was inadequate. And everything that the temple needed to do, Jesus did perfectly. There's also that the destruction of Israel's temple is judgment on Israel for their rejection and sin. That rejection was specifically demonstrated right before Jesus walks out of the temple. In the temple, he's not talking to the casual observer. In the temple, he's not talking to Joe the pagan who lives down the street. He's talking to the scribes and the Sadducees. He's talking to the rulers of the religious life of Israel. He's talking to the people that, religiously speaking, really mattered. The people who were responsible for maintaining the true faith of Israel. And so Jesus stands in the temple, in his Father's house, and those very people condemn him as a blasphemer and deserving of death. It's no surprise then that as he walks out of that temple, his mind is focused. And while his disciples see beautiful stones, he sees a place that will be destroyed because it is no longer necessary and because Israel's so-called faithful have rejected the one who is faithful. Ultimately, what that means is that this entire Olivet discourse, this entire lengthy passage that people get so worked up about to learn what's going to happen in the last days, this entire sermon is simply a farewell discourse. He's saying goodbye to his disciples. He's preparing to leave them, and he's drawing them into a place where they can begin to see reality and salvation as Christ himself sees reality and salvation. And that's why this entire discourse, which some would say is about helicopters and wars and rising nations and treaties, that's why this entire discourse, if you boil it down, is not filled with those things. If you start counting words to figure out what this sermon is really about, it's about two things. Consoling his people, that he will not be with them in body anymore, but that God will be with them in the trials that await. And it's about letting his people know, giving them words of instruction, admonition, to be on their guard, to watch out, to be ready. There's a lot more going on here than just black helicopters and locusts. And this is a very consistent theme in the Bible's last days teaching. And that's why we started this series in the Old Testament. Because when the Bible deals with the last days, its primary concern is not that you understand the timeline and the chronology and the events in a specific sense that will happen in the world around you. The Bible's primary concern when it talks about the last days is that you be consoled, that you as the people of God be reminded that God in His strength is with you, and that you be warned and admonished to be prepared, to stay awake, to keep watch, because you do not know the hour of His coming. The immediate context of this teaching that Jesus will give is the disciples' questions. If you go back to Matthew 24, I didn't do a good job of keeping the bookmark in mind. Matthew chapter 24, it's that same moment. He says there will not be one stone left upon another. But then in verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" There are two questions that the disciples have asked here. When will these things be? Now, we need to figure out what these things mean. And we don't have time to dig a lot into that tonight. So I'm just going to give you the answer. It's last days kinds of things. Jesus just talked about the destruction of the temple, which is one specific last days kind of things. But he's also going to talk about wars and rumors of wars, and it's going to use that phrase again, these things. It's going to talk about unrest. It's going to talk about false messiahs, and it's going to use those words again, these things. So what the disciples want to know is, when are these things going to start happening? When are we going to see this stuff that you're talking about? But they ask a second question. What will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? That is, what will be the things we can look for that tell us when you're coming back? What will tell us when we're at the end of all things? Two questions that the disciples ask. And they're reasonable questions in light of what Jesus just said about the destruction of the temple. Now, here's what I want you to know about Jesus going into this passage. Jesus is an utterly reasonable man and a very good teacher. When people ask questions of Jesus, do you know what he does? He answers them. Now, in the Gospels, you'll see moments where Jesus is asked questions and he doesn't answer them, but it's because they're a trap. It will say, Jesus, seeing into their hearts, did not fall for the trap. And so he turns the question on its head. It's the ancient equivalent of, how long ago did you stop beating your wife? Jesus sees that there's no right answer, and so he moves right past the question. There's also another kind of moment where Jesus doesn't answer. You see, at just before his ascension, he's standing on the beach and he's talking to the disciples. And one disciple says, well, what's going to happen to that guy? And Jesus doesn't give him an answer, except that he does. He says, it's none of your business. That is, he tells him why he's not going to answer the question. I tell you all of that because when you read the Olivet Discourse, the two questions that the disciples ask must be our framework for interpreting the passage. Because if Jesus doesn't answer their questions, then what was the point of the discourse? And so that's our framework as we go through it, that Jesus is going to answer their questions. He may say more than they asked for, but he will not say less. If he were going to say less, he would have given them a reason. It's none of your business. You don't need to know. Or, that's a stupid question. You shouldn't have asked it. But he doesn't do that. He just launches into this lengthy answer to their questions. And so that's what we have. Now go back to Mark, and we'll stick with Mark for a little while. Jesus begins answering their questions in verse 5. And Jesus began to say to them, "See that no one leads you astray." Now, from that verse, 5, all the way until verse 23, Jesus is going to describe the last days. Remember, their question, what they want to know is, when are these things going to happen? How are we going to know that we're seeing the kind of stuff you were talking about? And so Jesus begins to describe the condition of the last days. And within that, he'll describe one particular event of the last days, which is the destruction of the temple that we'll get to in a minute. But he's not only going to describe that specific event, he's going to describe the general condition, the same way that we heard that general condition described in Isaiah and in Daniel and in Hosea. You hear these descriptions of the sinfulness of the age and what that will bring about in the time before Jesus comes, and that's what we have here. From verse 5 to verse 23, he's not describing a length of time, he's describing a quality of time. He doesn't say the last days is going to be 1,062 days and it's going to start on March 1st. He says, oh, you want to know when the last days are going to start? Well, when you hear wars and rumors of war, you'll know that they've started. When you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to stand, you'll know that the last days have started. He doesn't describe this in quantity. He describes it in quality. So from verse 5 to verse 13, he speaks of general trials and tribulations, false messiahs, wars and rumors of war, the gospel going out into the world, which you got to understand in this very specific case simply means Gentiles. I know that some folks like to read into this verse that Jesus can't come back until we've reached every people group on the planet. That may or may not be true. It's certainly a good thing for us to try and reach every people group on the planet, and we should never restrain that effort. But that is not what this verse is saying. This verse is simply saying that when the gospel goes out to the Gentiles, you'll know that you're in the last days. When did that happen? Right? So that describes the condition of the last days. It's not speaking to how near Jesus' return might be. It's not saying when you see this, you know that Jesus is going to come tomorrow. It's describing the condition of the world before he comes. Now I'd ask you, is there any period of time you could look at between Jesus' ascension and the day we live in right now where these things are not true? Wars and rumors of war? False messiahs? The gospel going out to the Gentiles? He describes a period of time that was going to begin very soon from his answer of this question. But he doesn't suggest to them that the moment it begins, Jesus will come the moment after that. He says, when you see these things, you will know that every sign, everything that needs to happen before my coming will have happened. Everything is in place. Now, if that's the case, if it's the case that we're living in these last days, doesn't it explain why Jesus, when he talks about the last days, and John, when he talks about the last days in Revelation, their primary concern is how we live during the last days? Did you see how Jesus began this teaching? See that no one leads you astray. Jesus' concern is not that they can draw a colorful and graphic chart that explains the connectedness between the nations of this world. Jesus' concern is that they be ever watchful and waiting for His return. Now in the next section, verses 14 to 23, He answers their question specifically regarding the destruction of the temple. This is one thing, a very singular, specific event that will take place during the last days, the inner Advent period as it's called. This is one key thing that they can see and that they can be witnesses to and that they can know for certain that the last days are upon them. Now, how do we know that? Well, it's all wrapped up in that phrase, abomination of desolation, in verse 14. There are some words and phrases in the Bible that are technical terms. A technical term means you couldn't simply look it up in the dictionary to figure out what it means. It's a term that got its meaning from a particular context. And the term abomination of desolation refers to the destruction of the temple. It is specifically defined in the book of Daniel. And if you ever want to look that up in Daniel chapter 11, I think it's verse 31, you'll see that that phrase, abomination of desolation, would have been well understood by every Jew familiar with their Old Testament, that that means destruction of the temple. That's what that means. And it makes sense in this context, doesn't it? That was the question that was asked. Jesus talks about the temple being destroyed, and they say, when's the stuff like this going to happen? And Jesus says, well, stuff like this is going to happen for an age. You're going to hear wars and rumors of war. And that specific event, when you see the abomination of desolation, the thing I just described, not one stone being left upon another, when you see that, you will know that the age has come. You will know that you're in the last days. It's interesting, but not surprising, if you ever read the historical account of Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian in the early centuries. And Josephus wrote historical accounts of the first century church. Josephus was not a Christian. He was not writing favorable reviews of Christianity. He wasn't writing Bible books. He was writing history books about the period of time that we're talking about. And Josephus writes about AD 70. He writes about the siege of Jerusalem. He writes about the destruction of the temple. And it's fascinating, the words that he uses to describe it match the words that are used here to talk about people fleeing to the mountains as destruction came to the city and finally to the temple. This prophecy would come to pass. And nearly all of the church fathers, all of the early church commentaries, see AD 70 and the destruction of the temple as the fulfillment of this passage right here, verses 14 through 23. Remember the disciples' question. When will these things, not Jesus' coming, these things, the last days kinds of things, when will these things be? And so any view of this text that has Jesus failing to answer that question by pushing everything Jesus describes into the future needs to explain why Jesus wouldn't answer the disciples' question. Why they asked him a question about when is this stuff you just described going to happen, and then Jesus goes on a 2-chapter lecture about stuff they're never going to see. It'd be a very peculiar approach to the text. Question 2, and I'll be more brief on this one. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answers their question about the end of the age using all kinds of apocalyptic imagery. That fits. That's how we know that he's answering their question. I told you about technical terms, the abomination of desolation. There are other technical terms here. When you talk about riding on the clouds, when you talk about the sun being darkened, when you use the title for Jesus, Son of Man, these are second coming terms. They tell us that that's what Jesus was talking about. And it's important to recognize that Jesus is answering questions. He's not giving an airtight timeline. He's not moving verse by verse through the months and years of history to tell you what comes next. He's answering two questions. What are the signs of the end of the age? And so he uses apocalyptic imagery, verses 24 through 27. The sun darkened. Language about the great day of the Lord. This is Old Testament language, where it talks about the same event using the same language. It talks about the Son of Man riding on the clouds of heaven. Whenever the Bible talks about the Son of Man riding on the clouds of heaven, that is final judgment language. That is Jesus in his capacity as righteous judge who will judge both the living and the dead. That's another technical term. And all of this is a visible second coming, what we call consummation language. When is Jesus coming back? That's the language that he uses there in verses 24 to 27. They asked, when will all this take place? And so he says, verses 28 to 32, it's next. And we don't like that he doesn't say more than that, do we? But that's all he says. It's next. It comes after the last days. Once you see that the last days have begun, once you have the signs that tell you that we're now in the last days, all you can know for sure is that Jesus' coming is what's next. There's nothing else that needs to happen. There's nothing else that's yet to be done. There's no other prophecy that needs to be fulfilled. The last days will begin, and the next thing you will see, whenever that is, 5 years, 500 years, 5,000 years, 5 million years, whatever it is, from the beginning of the last days, the next thing you will see is the Son of Man coming on the clouds. And that's it. The second coming is the next thing. And I'll talk in a few minutes about how that eliminates the possibility of a rapture, a 7-year tribulation, a 1,000-year reign of peace. But Jesus is describing that that's what's next. We've got nothing else to look for, folks. And that reflects back on this idea that Jesus can't come back until we make sure to reach all these unreached people groups. Jesus is not waiting on us. It will be wonderful if we can reach them. I pray to God that we would be able to reach them and have the ability to communicate the gospel to them and that He would save them wherever they may be. But He ain't waiting on us. The only thing that's left to happen is the Son of Man coming on the clouds. How can you look at the ages and know that the only thing left to happen is Jesus' return? Well, Jesus says something pretty interesting to the disciples there. He says, even this generation will not pass away before seeing that that last days, that age, is already upon us. The very generation, the people that he's speaking to, they will see the kinds of signs that he's talking about that tell them the last days is upon us. And they certainly will in AD 70. They will get the sign loud and clear that what Jesus said is true, that the last days are at hand, and that now we wait for his coming. Therefore, and this is what's so key, beginning in verse 33, therefore, be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. Jesus' great concern is not that we would understand the timeline. It's that we would be ready. It's that we would understand that the time of His coming may already be at hand. We may not make it home tonight. Or He may tarry 1,000 years. But we must be ready. We must live as if He could come at any time. We must live with a sense of urgency for the gospel. This is one of the things that I really want you to get out of this sermon of Jesus's. When we read the Olivet Discourse, we have a tendency to be concerned with history or with predictive prophecy. Jesus's concern is pastoral. Jesus's concern is that you would be ready. It's that you would see that the time of His coming is at hand. That you would not put off meeting with His Son by faith. That you would not think you have all the time in the world to do what you want to do and to deal with God and His reckoning later. He wants us to ever be ready. We always think that we have more time. And maybe we do. But Jesus' concern is that we would never take that for granted. Now let me for a moment, that's probably the end of the sermon proper. But before we get into the Q&A, let me take a moment to give a critique of the other way of reading this passage, the dispensational premillennial view that many of us will have grown up in or spent time in. If you're looking at Mark, in that view, verses 32 through 37 speak of the rapture of Christians, where the moment of the rapture is not known and we have to be on guard, we have to stay awake, we should not be found asleep, and it's even more extensive in Matthew where it talks about two working in a field and one taken away. It's going to be such a surprising event, is the point of that text. So in their view, this part of the text speaks about the rapture of Christians, where Jesus will come back and the Christians, the believers, will be taken away. We won't be on earth anymore. It'll be only pagans, unbelievers here, and they will endure 7 years of tribulation. That's what verses 5 through 23 are about in this view, the seven-year tribulation. That's the wars and rumors of war. That's the earthquakes and the famines being the birth pains, nation against nation. Those verses are a description of a seven-year tribulation after the Christians have been raptured, that God will basically let Satan loose upon the earth, and for 7 years he'll have free reign to do whatever he would want to do. Verses 24 through 31 are talking about the second coming. But that second coming involves two things. It involves Jesus coming back after the seven-year tribulation, not bringing the Christians with him, but establishing a 1,000-year kingdom of peace on this earth where he will rebuild Israel, rebuild the temple, sit on the throne of Israel, and usher the Jews back into faithfulness through a 1,000-year reign of peace. And a final consummation, where everybody who believes gets brought together, church and Israel, and then that ushers us into the new age, whatever that would be after that point. So if you were keeping count, that's Jesus coming back three more times. Once to rapture his own, once to rule for 1,000 years, and then once, which is the second coming, which is the judgment and the end of all things. So that's our timeline of Jesus. And what we've been calling the last days, this entire sermon series, the premillennial dispensation view would say that's actually just the seven-year tribulation that comes in between the rapture and the 1,000-year reign of peace. So I want to be clear on what the view is before I critique it. I'll be quick, but I'm going to point out six problems with this view. The first is, what is the point of this two-chapter sermon that Jesus gives? If every single event Jesus mentions is far in the future, a rapture that the disciples will never see, a seven-year tribulation that the disciples will never experience, and then a second coming, how does Jesus think that this matters to them at all? He uses a lot of words with people who don't have any vested interest in what he's talking about. Jesus gives so many imperatives in this section about how they ought to live, but he's apparently giving them to people who won't have anything to do with these moments. Second critique, he never answers the disciples' question about the temple. If every event described in these chapters is in the future, if the abomination of desolation, if the wars and rumors of war, if all of these events are in the future after the rapture, then what about the disciples' questions? When is the temple going to get torn down? He never answered it. Third, He uses the word you a lot in this sermon. But who is he talking about? What does he mean when he says you if he's talking to people who are going to be long since dead before any of these events take place? Fourth, the phrase abomination of desolation is a technical term with specific known meaning. It means the destruction of the temple, and nobody argues about that. The dispensationalist view admits that that term means the destruction of the temple. What they say then is that that tells us that a temple must be rebuilt so that in the 7-year tribulation, it can be torn down and fulfill this prophecy. Now, in philosophy, there's something called Occam's razor, which is you're not allowed to make up complicated explanations when a simple one will suffice. We have a temple already. We have a temple already that was destroyed already. Why do we need to project another temple into the future and another destruction of that temple into the future just to twist this passage enough to make it fit our preconceived notion? Fifth, how do you account for Jesus looking at the disciples and saying, without stuttering, this generation will not pass away until these things happen? Since we hold, in our view, that he's talking about the kinds of things that take place in the last days, we see that fulfilled in the sight of the disciples. The disciples saw wars and rumors of wars. They saw false messiahs. They saw nation against nation. They saw the abomination of desolation. It's not hard for us to look at the passage and say, yep, Jesus was right when he said, this generation will not pass away until all these things happen. But what do you do in the dispensational view? If you push all the fulfillment of these prophecies into the future, what exactly was it that this generation was going to see? Sixth is the chronology. Now, we hold that Jesus isn't giving a last day's chronology, but in the dispensational view, he is. He's setting out the order of events that these things are going to happen and take place. But that makes a lot of sense until you get to verse 32, when suddenly Jesus has been talking about this period of tribulation. He's been talking about all the things that are going to happen in the 7-year tribulation. And then in verse 32, he goes backwards and starts talking about the rapture that supposedly is going to happen before that. The chronology doesn't make sense. But I think the biggest critique, and this is the only one that I care if you remember, the biggest critique is, what's the point of the text? What is Jesus' purpose in saying these words? Does he seem to be concerned with our ability to know about all the mechanics of how the plan unfolds for God governing the universe? That's not what I see. I see imperatives urging us how we ought to live our lives in these difficult days. I see comfort promising us of his return without getting us bogged down in the details. I see patience with people who do want to know more than they should. We like to know more. It gives us a sense of control. This is why the false messiahs tempt us away. We love it if they have something more to say that came from God than is in the Bible. But Jesus, again and again, tells us to beware, to be on our guard, to be watchful. None of that is good for us. You see, God tells us so much more than helicopters and Middle East wars and alliances and NATO. God tells us to live well by the power of His Spirit, as we wait for the coming of His Son. And frankly, the fact that that text, that Jesus' most lengthy teaching in the entire Gospels, in that view, becomes useful to me, is the only reason I need to take that interpretation. Because I believe that Jesus' primary concern is the instruction and the comfort and the encouragement of His people.